Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb, coming to you live from Roberto's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Julia Tertian. I write about food, and my favorite part about what I do is finding out the stories and meeting the people behind great recipes, restaurants, and more. Every Wednesday, I get to have these conversations on air, bringing the pages of Cherry Bomb magazine to life by interviewing some of the most interesting women in the world of food. You can listen to the show live every Wednesday at 2 p.m. on heritageradionetwork.org or download it anytime on iTunes. Today, I'm delighted to have two very, very cool women in the studio with me. Alex Reich, the chef and owner of not one, not two, but three very acclaimed Spanish restaurants in New York, El Quinto Pino, which is newly expanded, and Chiquito, both in Chelsea, and Lavara in Cobble Hill. And in the second segment, I'll be talking with Molly Culver, who I will just simply describe as a very proactive farmer, and she's doing all sorts of things to make Brooklyn a much greener place. A veritable farm-to-table show. I'm really excited to hear from Molly and Alex about the ins and outs of growing, cooking, and serving food in New York. Alex, let's start with you. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. I'm so happy to get this chance to chat with you. I would like to know a little bit more. I'm going to back up before we talk about restaurants and all that kind of fun stuff about you. So where did you grow up?
I grew up in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I spent like all of my youth there. It was actually a great place to grow up. Grew up near a lake. There's lots of them there. And had an herb garden, but not like a vegetable garden. And I had a pretty urban upbringing. It was a small city, but it was like very easy to navigate as a young person. So I enjoyed a lot of freedom.
Do you go back there?
I don't, because I don't, not even my parents are there, sadly. I do have a good friend who just moved back, like kind of repatriated. So I'm looking forward to getting back out there.
I've never been, but I hear the greatest things about Minneapolis. It's supposed to be a great food place these days.
I've heard that it is. It was, it wasn't not a great food place when I was growing up. I mean, the population is like very, like sort of very sophisticated. But there weren't like amazing restaurants when I was a kid. So we did a lot of ethnic eating, which I think was a great asset to me.
Yeah, I was about to ask, was your family into food when you were growing up?
Yeah, my parents are both from Argentina, and they're immigrants, and just were always fairly open. I mean, and I think coming from Argentina, they had this like connection to Spanish, Jewish, and Italian cooking. That they, you know, fostered in us as well. And then we added to that a lot of, like, Vietnamese, Hmong, and tons of Chinese eating, Lebanese in some parts of St. Paul. There wasn't, you know, a ton of variety in Minneapolis, but they really sought it out, and they sort of grew into their food fascination.
was all that different kinds of food you were eating, Chinese food, Lebanese food, was that being cooked at home or you were getting that in restaurants?
No, we would go to restaurants for that, and I was like a real high point. You know, going to restaurants together as a family was just what we looked forward to. That's what we did together. That was like our family time.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, my mom would try to come back and like kind of, you know, try to
recreate
freestyle. Yeah. some of that stuff. They were, you know, it was the 70s. So they would do a lot of like Indian potluck and everybody would bring a dish. So it was like very like Midwestern by way of like, you know, fake
I
exotic.
Fake exotic. That could be the name of your next restaurant. Fake exotic. How did you arrive at Spanish cooking and Spanish food and mostly Basque food?
Well, Spanish cooking, I think, you know, I had the Spanish language, which was very helpful. And when I went to cooking school, I started reading a lot about contemporary Spanish cooking, like that vanguard. I was really interested in going to Spain to cook. And to be honest, I just kind of got a little sidetracked. I took a job at a Spanish restaurant wanting to get like a couple connections. I didn't know at the time there weren't like programs that were like, you know, sending American students there. And so I thought that would be the best way to do it. And it might have been an okay way, except for I ended up like falling in love with this Spanish guy. And then we sort of went on this path of eventually opening up Spanish restaurants together. But I think I just had an affinity for the cuisine. My mom cooked a lot of Spanish dishes at home. I mean, if you grew up in Argentina or as part of an Argentine family, all your friends are Gallegos or Vascos. And you know their dishes. That doesn't mean that the expression of those dishes was very authentic or even very delicious all the time. But I knew those dishes. I just intuitively knew them.
That actually leads right into my next question, which was I wanted to actually ask you about that word, which I'm sort of hesitant to use because it's a little precarious and maybe overused, but it's about authenticity. And it's been on my mind because a few shows ago we had Jody Williams here who runs Bouvette, and Jody's also a dear friend of mine. And I think it's fascinating that Jody, who's an American chef, has a French restaurant, Bouvette, not only in New York, but she opened one in Paris. And that's been really fun for her. And it's also been so widely celebrated by the Parisian community. And I think there's something so interesting in that. And then, so that was on my mind. And then getting ready to talk to you today, I was rereading a lot of interviews and stuff you've done. And you did an interview with Eater 2 years ago. I think it was right after Lavara opened. And something you said really resonated with me. And you talked about the restaurant and you were saying that you don't worry about it being very authentic, but it's still very earnest and the food is accessible. So I would just love to hear a little bit more about that. And like, do you think about authenticity when you're creating dishes or even when you're writing the names of them on your menus?
I do. I think about authenticity a lot, and I want to be true to the cuisine, but Lavara, of all our restaurants, is the most improvisational because it's really a celebration of the Jewish and Moorish legacy in Spanish cooking. I wanted to go and tease out the stories behind these dishes, or I wanted to pick dishes that to me so obviously came out of these traditions that are so ignored in Spain. So it's a part of my relationship with Spain, which is like, can't you see, you know, where this came from? Because, you know, Spain has, you know, I guess like the American South in some ways, like a conflicted relationship with its past and the people who used to live there. And
it's so regional too.
And I wanted to bring, it was kind of like a credit due restaurant. Like, I'm like, oh, that's Jewish. And, you know, most Spaniards would be like, no, it's not. And that's so Jewish to me. I really wanted to focus on that, and I also didn't want to open the same restaurant, and I wanted to be able to play. Me and my husband have always enjoyed a lot of freedom in terms of being like innovative within Spanish cuisine, but we've always done it very conservatively because we always wanted to have Spanish restaurants and celebrate Spanish food. So even when we took liberties, we were really careful to make sure that we were always taking liberties that either someone in Spain would naturally take or that were a natural evolution. Like, we always felt really good about using dashi and stuff like that because it's bonito, and bonito is this huge Basque or Spanish ingredient. And we'll use fish sauce instead of anchovies. And we like to play and we like to be thoughtful about and creative. But we define our style in very narrow terms. And, you know, my husband worked in Japanese food for a long time, so, you know, we play there sometimes too. But with Lavara, I really wanted to be able to celebrate Middle Eastern flavors. They were flavors that were speaking to me, and I had been working in sort of the Basque world, which is, you know, I think what's confusing for a lot of people about Basque cuisine is that it's not a Mediterranean cuisine. There are some Mediterranean ingredients, but it's not Mediterranean. And so people don't recognize it so easily as being the Spanish, you know, like tomato, pepper, saffron.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Kind of thing. And I wanted to go back to those flavors because I missed them, but I didn't want to tell the same story. So that's where Lavara came from.
And I love that notion of you run three restaurants with your husband, but you don't run three of the same restaurants. It's not a chain in any way. How would you define each of the restaurants? Like, as you know, you're sort of like, what would it say on their business cards?
I always say, you know, El Quinto Pino is a multi-regional tapas restaurant. And when I first opened Okintopino, I really wanted to celebrate the tapas tradition sort of as a social tradition. And so I really wanted people to eat standing up. So the bar, it started out as a 400 square foot bar. We've just added a dining room, but even the dining room has been added in a way that is very, dare I say, authentic to how people eat in Spain. A lot of times you're like belly up at the bar, and that is one way of eating and interacting. And then like there's a birthday party in the back, or a baptism in the back at a table, or someone's having a quieter dinner. And a lot of times that also differentiates AM and PM eating.
Oh, interesting.
There.
Yeah.
Here it functions, it's a little different. It's just now a more flexible way for people to be able to enjoy the food however they want.
Yeah.
But I really wanted people to eat standing up.
And Chiquito?
At the time. And Chiquito is it's a Basque restaurant. There weren't any Basque restaurants that were I thought true to the cuisine and true to this idea of materia prima, which is like very ingredient driven food. There was just nothing like it. So Chiquito was sort of a labor of love and just wanting to communicate. We wanted to go from sort of general to specific. We knew that the best way to sort of set a new standard for Spanish cuisine was through tapas, but we really wanted to talk about individual regional cuisines.
I think
and
you do.
So that's what Chiquito is about, being more particular.
Yeah, I think you do such a great job at sort of explaining the origins of where the restaurants come from, where the dishes come from. It all sounds like it would make a great book, which I hear you're about to do, which is super. Yeah, so it was just announced that Alex got a book deal, so I'm sure you're starting on that process. I'd like to ask you a few questions just about the business of running your businesses. And so first and foremost, you and your husband work together, which I would love to know.
I'm nodding.
You're nodding. How do you guys define your roles? Are they even defined? How does it
pretty
go?
Pretty organic, but they are defined. We try to do what everyone tries to do, what they're good at and sort of what they enjoy. And of course, everyone has to do a lot of what they don't enjoy, because that's sort of the nature of this business. So my husband does a lot of operational stuff, and I do a lot of like menu planning and concept building and storytelling, and catch up with all the email and all the communication part of the restaurant. And then Edder's really good at training staff, so he trains a lot of incoming staff, and then I tend to mentor sort of long-term staff more. I don't know how that ended up happening, yeah. But that's just kind of how it happens. So he goes in the day and makes sure that, you know, fridges are clean, everything's like super organized, and then I get there later, usually from the farmer's market or something, put together the specials. By then he's like moved on to another task, and we try to touch all the restaurants every day, at least one of us, and sometimes both of us.
It sounds like you guys balance each other really well.
We balance each other very well. We do not lead a balanced lifestyle.
Well, that was my next question.
Because we're like half of one person.
Yeah, that's so funny. That was my next question. And then talking about you going to all the restaurants every day. So again, two of them are in Chelsea.
One is
in Cobble Hill.
Yeah.
You guys live on the Lower East Side.
Mm-hmm.
You guys also have two children. So you have two kids, three restaurants. You're in two boroughs.
Yeah.
It's a lot. It's a lot of logistics.
We are right in the middle between Brooklyn and, I mean, we're two stops in on a train from Brooklyn and two stops, well, not two stops, but, you know, several stops from Chelsea.
So you're at the halfway point.
Yeah.
How does it all work? Not sort of theoretically, but in reality. Like, what's your typical day?
Well, I always joke that my husband's extremely efficient and really good at time management, and he is able to be really efficient because I'm incredibly inefficient and vice versa. It starts at breakfast, and breakfast is our family meal. And not family meal, restaurant family meal, but family meal. And And so we enjoy a not super nutritious but super enjoyable breakfast with our kids. Our kids are not the best, you know, morning eaters, and my son's not a very good eater in general. But we hang out in the morning, and that's a really fun time for us. And then we hurry up and get everybody to school. My daughter goes to school in Brooklyn, so that is convenient. We drop her off, and then one of us will go to Lavara. And then that person will either stay there for a little while. Sometimes it's a quick visit. Sometimes it's all day. And then we usually hook back up at Chiquito at lunchtime, like at 3 o'clock. And the opposite one of us will have gone to the farmer's market, gone to Chinatown to pick up certain things that we pick up there. Just like any kind of hand shopping stuff or fixing stuff. There's a lot to fix.
It seems to be a common theme.
And then we kind of meet back up in the afternoon. And then one of us will stay. One of us will stay till 7, and one of us will stay the night, usually in Chelsea.
So it sounds like you guys have figured out a bit of a system.
We figured it out. Yeah. I mean, I think for so far, I think it, as our kids get older, it will be, that's not going to work as well.
How old are they now?
They're, my daughter's about to turn 5 and 2.5. And I think just the older your kids get, the busier they get, and the more they want you to, like, celebrate their lives. And,
yeah.
Like,
which is
you
great.
Know, their soccer or whatever yeah. they're doing. And we'll have to work on that.
Yeah. Well, speaking of your family breakfast, and we're almost out of time, so I'm going to go right into our Cherry Bomb Rapid Fire Q&A,
okay.
which are the 8 questions we ask every guest.
Oh, okay.
Super fast, no pressure, no worries. Number 1, sweet or salty?
Salty.
What did you have for breakfast today?
Coffee.
What are you reading right now?
I just started it, and watch me get the title wrong. It's it's called like Bird Boy Snow or Snow. It's brand
I believe
new.
You. I'm not sure.
But it's like a Snow White, a contemporary Snow White thing.
That sounds cool. Yeah. If I were to look into your refrigerator at home right now, what might I be surprised to find?
That it's full, because we just went shopping and it never is.
What's your go-to snack?
Nuts.
Nuts. That's a common answer. Where do you want to travel to next?
Well, I'm going to the Basque Country,
So
I want to travel there.
Perfect.
And Tulum.
Awesome. And lastly, what was your favorite meal when you were a kid?
Milanesa la Napolitana, which is basically like a veal cutlet, but with also like ham, tomato sauce, melted cheese.
That sounds delicious. Alex, it's always really wonderful to see you, and I'm so happy to get to talk to you about some more of what you do. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to be back with Molly Culver.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. You know, there's no more telling aspect, no more revealing virtue of a group of people having evolved in a lovely way than how they feed themselves, how they entertain, how they put food on the table, what they put on the table. Heritage Radio Network provides the clearest evidence that there's hope for us yet. Heritage Radio is like Fairway Market in that we both care deeply about what you're having for dinner tonight. Heritage Radio Network is not just about food, though. Every time I tune in, I learn something about things other than food, too. Architecture, design, stuff like that. But from where I stand, I still say, if you can't eat it, what's the point? For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Hi, welcome back to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm your host, Julia Tertian. We were just speaking with Alex Reich, the chef and owner of El Quinto Pino, Chiquito, and Lavara, and now we're going to turn the microphone over to Molly Culver. Hi, Molly.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going great. Molly, you've been described as many things, a farmer, a floral designer, a volunteer, a community organizer, an activist. How would you describe yourself? What do you say when someone asks you what you do?
I guess I say first and foremost that I'm a farmer, because that's what I've mainly been doing for the past 10 years or so. The floral design is more recent. Started a business a couple years ago with another urban farmer, Deborah Gregg. But I got to farming through a wave of different experiences. So, yeah.
Well, I would love to hear about some of them, because I want to talk about what you're doing now, but I want to understand a little bit more about how you got there. So what were the experiences that led you to now farming in Brooklyn?
Oh, gosh. I wish I could just say something simple and say, you know, I loved gardening as a kid, but it certainly wasn't that. I grew up in a pretty suburban, white, middle-class community and went to Barnard College here in the city. So,
as did I.
Oh, amazing.
We could talk about that.
Strong Barnard woman. So kind of moved from suburban to an urban environment. And then I would say that I had a couple really pivotal experiences in my life. One, that I was in a pretty serious car accident when I was 17,
oh, wow.
Which kind of shook up my whole reality. And two, I spent a year in South America when I had just graduated from Barnard. So when I was 21, 22. And I think just spending a year outside of the U.S. In a country that looked different, felt different, operated differently, but it was so under the influence of the level of consumption that kind of was set as a bar mm-hmm. by the U.S.
Where were you?
I was in Chile. I'm sorry. Okay. I was in Chile and lived in Santiago. And I did travel around a bit, but I was pretty much living and working in Santiago and learning Spanish and trying to figure out what to do with my life. But I was also reporting for a small little kind of sideshow newspaper on environmental issues and indigenous rights issues. And kind of when I came back from that experience, it really hit me kind of how our society is set up mm-hmm. and was very impactful and was sort of traumatic in certain ways. And fortunately, I found a small urban farm to volunteer in New Haven that was being managed by Josh Fiertel, who went on to work for Slow Food. And it was really just a visceral reaction of like, I love doing this, that kept me motivated to keep doing it. But it was backed by sort of a framework for a need for more social justice and environmental justice in the world. And I felt like that had to start here in the U.S.
It sounds like you sort of went a long way to get a lot of perspective and
that's
terrific.
Multi-layered. And
so currently you're managing the youth farm in mm-hmm. Crown Heights. Can you tell us a bit more about what that is? And where
sure.
is it?
Okay. So the youth farm is located on a front lawn of a high school building or a high school campus called Wingate. It's on Kingston Avenue in Crown Heights, right next to Kings County Hospital. Mm-hmm. And the farm was founded 5 years ago as a joint project between the Department of Education and the High School for Public Service and BK Farmyards, which is an organization I belong to. We now have a fiscal sponsor, Green Gorillas, which is a very longstanding community gardening support organization, which acts as our fiscal sponsor. And so basically our mission is to provide space for farm education and training for people in the community, and that really means the wider New York City community.
So it's not just for the high school students?
It is not just for the high school, no. We run all different kinds of programs for different people, different ages, different interests
That's
and
so
goals.
Great.
Yeah.
And as your title is you're the farm manager.
Mm-hmm.
So as the farm manager, what are your responsibilities?
So mainly what sets me apart from my cohorts is I write the vegetable and flower crop plan. So in the winter, I'm really busy doing a lot of sort of research and sitting in front of Excel sheets and crunching numbers.
So what do one of those plans look like?
It looks like an Excel document with maybe 15 different pages on it.
Okay.
Each one describes a different aspect of farm management. So it could be the greenhouse sowing schedule. It could be what we're predicting to be in our CSA shares week by week. It could be a spreadsheet about, you know, various streams of income that we're expecting to come in. A lot of different things.
So it's a real full picture.
A very full picture of what should be happening on the farm day to day, because once the warm weather hits, there's just no time to do that kind of planning. So it's just time to start sowing seeds, and you got to know how many you need to plant and where they're going to go.
Where you're putting them.
Yeah.
What's going to happen when
so
they grow.
So there's that. But
so it's a lot of planning.
A lot of planning. And then the other main thing is we run an adult farm training program called the Urban Farm Training Program. So we're usually looking at feedback from that program and working on improving it for the following year and running applications and interviews for people that want to come and train as beginning farmers at the youth farm.
That's so, so super. I think a lot of people have a tendency to romanticize farming. I would love to hear a little bit about the realities and what it's like from your perspective, specifically urban farming.
Sure. Well, it's underpaid. It's a lot of long hours. Mm-hmm. It can be pretty exhausting physically. Now, those are definite downsides sometimes when you're running low on energy, and you're, especially in New York City, when you're trying to pay your rent. Mm-hmm. Those two things don't necessarily equate very well, being a farmer and
a New Yorker.
And a New Yorker. Yeah. But I think it's so important on so many different levels. And so just being able to be there and provide the space and share the experience I have with other people that want to go on and potentially become farmers in rural areas, then I think it's worth it.
And how do you make it work financially, if you don't mind me asking? Is it all through the Green Gorillas being your fiscal sponsor, or are there other sources of income?
Yeah, it's really difficult to write a grant to pay a farmer just to be a farmer. We can raise money to do education and training, which is awesome. So I think of myself sort of as a farmer slash teacher, because I'm really spending the majority of my time working side by side beginning farmers, whether those are youth or adults. But the income that we make through our produce sales and our flower sales accounts for almost 30% of our whole budget. So there's three part-time paid people on the farm. Two of us are farmers and one of us works with youth and does educational work with young people. I'm 22 hours on the farm. I say that in quotation marks for the listeners. But I also run my own business on the side to make ends meet.
The floral business, which I would love to ask you a few more questions about. So your floral design company is called Molly Oliver, which is your middle name.
Yeah.
I think that the push towards more sort of environmental sustainability in the floral community is a really, really wonderful thing. And I think it's something that's often not thought about, especially in a world and a community that's so aware of local and organic food, about seasonality. I always think about the home cook these days who's so tuned into all this, who will go to the farmer's market instead of maybe going to like a big box grocery store, who will buy produce, who will talk to the farmer, who will then maybe compost at the end of this. But on their way home, they'll stop at the florist and pick up a dozen of whatever flowers and not really, you know, make the connection that these flowers had to be flown in from somewhere and they weren't grown locally. And I think it's sort of often easy to forget that a flower is something that's grown just like a vegetable or an herb. So I think what you're doing is amazing, and I would love for you to tell people a little bit more about what you're doing. And I'm just curious if you feel like the public is getting more aware of this. And
absolutely. Yeah, I think there's been definitely an upswing in awareness in terms of slow flowers, if I may borrow Deborah Prinzing's coined term. I've joined an incredible community, existing community of domestic flower growers. I would call them the last men and women standing, really, because we used to have a pretty vibrant floriculture or floral industry, flower growing industry in this country, both in California and the Pacific Northwest, as well as Long Island, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. But just like with vegetables and fair trade and that whole sort of global economic system, it's pushed floral agriculture into developing countries, quote unquote, and where land is cheaper, where labor is underpaid and often abused. And so it's not a great situation socially as well as environmentally. And so, but there's still a pretty vibrant community of flower growers, and they, a lot of them are very well connected with each other. And so I've joined an association called the American Association of Specialty Cup Flower Growers, sort of a wordy acronym, the ASCFG.org. But they're incredible, and they all share their knowledge with each other. So a lot of what I've learned about flower growing has come out of my That's own so training cool. as a farmer, but also through this network that holds workshops and conferences. And so in my design company, we basically purchase primarily from growers in New Jersey and Long Island and Pennsylvania that come to Union Square Green Market or Grand Army Plaza.
That's so awesome.
Yeah, it's fun.
I think it's always, that organization sounds amazing. I think it's always incredible to sort of put like-minded people together and people who are sort of, you know, doing the right thing. And then when you put them all together, it becomes just bigger and louder. And that's always wonderful. I think one of the most amazing, just to end on that, I think one of the most amazing things I've seen that was just so just proactive and direct and logical was my wife Grace stumbled upon your Pinterest page, which I thought was so great because awesome. You and everyone should go see it. So your Pinterest, what do you call it? Your handle is?
Yeah, it's just Molly Culver.
Molly Culver. So Molly has organized your pages are flowers by month and by season and mm-hmm. what grows locally. So you can really get a sense of, mm-hmm. you know, what is good to, you know, put in a bouquet on your dining room table or give as a gift, or maybe someone's having a wedding or another big event. And I love seeing it all there in such an easy to sort of digest way. So I thought that was great. And so I just wanted to make sure to mention
to know.
That.
Yeah. Someone found it.
So we're going to segue just cause we're almost out of time into our Cherry Bomb Rapid Fire Q&A, which are the 8 questions we ask every guest who comes on.
Oh boy.
Totally easy. No pressure. No worries. So whatever first comes to mind.
Okay.
Number 1, sweet or salty?
Oh, sweet.
Sweet. Number 2, what did you have for breakfast today?
A chocolate bagel with tofu cream cheese from Brooklyn.
A chocolate bagel?
Mm-hmm.
Awesome.
Brooklyn bread. The best bagels in Brooklyn.
What neighborhood?
Cobble Hill and Park Slope.
Yeah,
there's
awesome.
Only 2 of them.
Okay. What are you reading right now?
Johnny's catalog, Johnny's seed catalog. Only that.
Great answer. If I were to look into your refrigerator right now, what might I be surprised to find?
What would you be surprised to find? Hellman's mayonnaise.
It's in ours too. No worries. What's your go-to snack?
Oh, go-to snack, peanut butter.
Mm. What's your favorite time of day?
Morning.
Where do you want to travel to next?
Maine, because I'm going there in August.
Oh, great.
So I'm focused on that.
And lastly, what was your favorite meal when you were a kid?
Chicken Marbella. It was something my mom cooked a lot. Prunes and green olives.
Yeah,
and
it's from the Splendid Table book, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or the Silver Palette cookbook. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I don't know why I just confused that.
Marcella Hazan, is that right?
I think. Was it in hers?
I think
we'll
so.
We'll have to double check. That's a great dish. A classic. Well, Molly, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks
I know
so much
I've
for having
learned
me.
So much. It's fascinating to find out what goes into producing food. I mean, quite literally. And thank you also to Alex for being here. Tune in next Wednesday at 2:00 on Heritage for another episode of Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.